this past week, a prominent Bay Area yoga teacher self-published on Facebook a very passionate and in some ways a lot of words have been used to describe it, repulsive might be one, rant primarily about the evils of feminism. And it had the flavor in it of an aspect of the men's rights movement that veers strongly toward misogyny and anger, that it claims is not directed toward women but toward feminism as an ideology, and errs in that claim. This teacher's post received instantly a storm, one could use a stronger word, of comments, mostly, almost entirely, telling him that he was absolutely out of line. And I was one of those commenters. I tried to be as nice as I could. It was hard to compose a comment to a hateful essay. And I know this person, and we're not close, we were never close, but we were peers. We both taught here in this room at different times. He's been out of the area for some time. But I've had him at my house, and like a lot of other people who commented, I was surprised to read it. And several of his friends, like other teachers, the response was like, WTF, dude. Like, where did this come from? We know you. What's going on? And his response was, you know, I finally feel free enough to express my views. So I want to speak a little bit about patriarchy and misogyny, and a little bit about what he could have said but didn't about male oppression. And in the context of the Dharma, or of teachings that urge us toward liberation and ethical action and seeing clearly. In a way, the post doesn't deserve a talk in rebuttal, as much as what's already happened, which is that he's lost most of his friends, been fired from the studio where he teaches, and probably won't work again in the yoga world. All of which in a certain way are not the right response. It's good, actually, that he's not standing in front of rooms of women teaching, which was his business. I wouldn't ever send a woman to be his student. But those responses, which are appropriate and come from anger, also in a certain way miss the point. So our practice, coming from the early Buddhist and yoga streams, can be characterized in some ways as a liberation psychology hinged on a profound respect for the effects of one's actions. So this is embedded in the teachings called karma, or kamma in Pali, the teachings on action and their results. And the teachings on kamma or karma are the hinge of the whole liberation ideal in Buddhism and yoga. And I'll stop saying both. I'm going to lean as I do generally in the details toward the early Buddhist teachings that are virtually identical with the early yoga teachings. And another night we can talk about that, their differences. The Buddha is clear that the thing that we long to be free from is not life or even the pain that is associated with life directly, but the patterns of mind or heart that respond to the world by, in a strange way, we could almost say, overreacting. We receive the sensations of pain and loss and grief that are inevitable when one has a form, has human form, but has any form in the system, animal form, godly form, hellish form. The error that we make is that we over-identify with the self that is the recipient of changing circumstances. And we think that happiness is to be attained by diminishing the conditions in the world that are painful and increasing the ones that are pleasant. And the Buddha says this is an error. What we need to do is diminish the response in ourselves to the painful and the pleasant in order to let go of the patterns of reactivity that govern our actions and cause us to endlessly add more harm to the world. And the hinge between ethics and letting go is profound here. It doesn't just say, become deeply equanimous or let go of reactivity and then you'll be happy. It says, let go of reactivity so that your actions no longer contribute to further pain. And this part isn't emphasized as much to the extent that Buddhism, early Buddhism particularly, is often felt or overreacted to, and the early renunciate yogas likewise, as a kind of world-denying path. That if you just turn away from both the pleasures and the pains of the world, you can achieve a kind of transcendent serenity that then sort of unbinds you from everything. Up and out was the old saying. But that's not what the Buddha was proposing, as far as I can tell. Because the discourses are filled with reflection on and teachings on not how to dissolve only, but how to act and how to be in relationship and how to be in community. The teachings on how to properly be in the community of monastics are far larger than the teachings, the wisdom teachings themselves. It's a bigger basket of texts, the Vinaya, the teachings on the monastic discipline. So as we learn to respond differently and in a more balanced way to the weather that is sometimes sunny and sometimes rainy, meaning pleasant and painful perhaps as a metaphor, not only do we rest in peacefulness in ourselves more, but resting in peacefulness changes how we exist in the world. It changes what we ask from others, because our relationships become less and less governed by need, by the desire to get something from somebody or to resist something from somebody. What these teachings are is, in a certain way, they do lean toward the inner or the individual initially as the locus of practice. And this is a critique that became really active in the kind of through the middle of the last century and into the 70s and 80s and 90s, particularly as a stream of Buddhism called engaged Buddhism began to ask where in this body of beautiful liberatory teachings could one find the support for vigorous social action, the actions that would actually lean into change social conditions rather than just accept them as they are and become more inwardly balanced. And they found that justification in many places, particularly in the ideal of the bodhisattva, the being from the Mahayana tradition, somewhat later than the earliest Buddhist tradition, the being who is so devoted to the welfare of others that they forego an aspect of their own liberation in order to serve perpetually. But I think that we can also find an imperative for a certain kind of social action in the earliest texts themselves in a few different ways. And to touch on what those might be, I want to say a little bit about kind of some of the implications or the topics in this person's angry essay. The target in many ways of the essay was body of thought and practice called feminism. And in some ways, it was enunciated more with anger than academic rigor, because it's difficult to enunciate such a view with academic rigor, since there's hardly any support for it in the historical record. But the sense that I got from what was there was that the author was responding to a perceived sequence of, in a sense, insults that go back, you know, millennia. This is ridiculous, but we can say that part of the mistake to be kind in it was to not recognize the purpose of such a thing as feminism or any social liberation ideology or body of practice. And it's the same mistake that opponents of affirmative action make when they say, if we want a post-racial society, we shouldn't do anything that preferences one group over another. Where the proponents of affirmative action might say, if we want to work toward a post-racial society and be real about the fact that we're not in one, we need to be proactive in uplifting the conditions of those who have been left behind in the dominant system. What the author of this essay, whom I'm not naming, not because it's a secret, you can find it easily on Facebook, but partly because I'm not intending this talk to be a personal attack as much as a reflection on an ideology that unfortunately in the current new administration and the recent election has been amplified. And this paper, one of the commenters said, dude, is this your audition essay for Breitbart? Mm-hmm. Like, this is the same kind of language that's being used in the reactionary right wing to demonize folks who are not white, to demonize folks who are queer, to demonize, to exclude Muslims specifically and those who are other to a particular dominant group. It's the same kind of language. We believe in equality for all, therefore we should not do anything to help anyone. So what this commentator could have said, rather than saying, you know, the ideology of feminism is just as wrong as any other discrimination, and has the idea, I'm not going to repeat his arguments. What he could have said, because what was missing was an analysis of power, what he could have said is, I feel oppressed. And where can I locate the conditions of that oppression? And I think he just made a mistake in locating them with a fellow resistance movement, feminism, which also is a representation of the feeling of being oppressed and a response to oppression. I think an appropriate response to oppression, working to uplift the very real conditions of inequality, of those on the dispossessed side or the excluded side in an unequal system. What he could have said is, I feel oppressed, what's happening here? Oppression is coming to me as a member of a group by the conditions that I live in. And I would place the locus of those oppressive conditions not in an opponent, as if it were a dyadic system and a scarcity system where if one group is uplifted, another group must not be. I would place it in an umbrella system that we could call patriarchy or neoliberalism more recently, but in terms of gender, which was his main complaint, although it's not random that he's also white and straight. So straight white male patriarchy, we could say. Because if we use our practice to look at both the conditions that give rise to pain and suffering and how our actions can either contribute to or lessen those conditions, can change those conditions for others in the future or amplify them, we find, this is one of the places where I think the hinge between the inner cultivation and systemic action is really clear. We find that inner work alone won't change the external conditions unless I make that connection that is the teaching of karma, the connection that my actions, which means inaction as well, always are part of the system. I'm never separate from it. And so what I do or don't do helps to create how the overarching system moves forward. How does this mean I could trace my suffering as a man, say, to patriarchy? Part of what I want to do in my internal practice, as we talk about often here, is I want to understand the patterns of mind that govern my actions, right? If we're talking about what are the conditions that inspire action for all of us of any form, we are looking at patterns of action and response. And our training, which starts with a training in focus and then becomes a training in a kind of inner inquiry to really understand what's happening for me, what's motivating my feelings, my actions right now. It becomes a search for the cause of suffering. And how can I let go of what I'm doing to contribute to my own suffering? As we do that work, so I'm doing this in the direction from the inner to the outer to start with. As I do that work, part of what I find, and I'll be I'll use myself as a real example, since I'm kind of circling around a little bit the topic of male oppression here, which is what I wish this teacher had talked about if he wanted to talk about anything rather than what he did. As I search in myself for the patterns that cause my own suffering, I find things that that I associate with being raised a boy and then a man in this culture. I find patterns of how I conduct myself in relationship. I find patterns of how I relate to or don't or know nothing about aspects of myself, like the emotional or the intimate. I was raised by a Stoic scientist who's a wonderful man, and we're telling him now to his face that he's a tough old brick, because he just came through a stroke after four times surviving cancer, and after the stroke, you know, a week after the stroke, he was just like in his mumbly voice, because they hadn't given him his teeth back yet. He was kind of saying, like, I hate this hospital. Won't they let me go home? Get me out of here. This place is terrible. Mm-hmm. And as soon as he got home, he was like, that sucked. That was awful. Brah. And I'm like, it's you. You're back, you know? And we're like, dude, nothing takes this guy out. You know, God willing. Something eventually will. But part of his legacy to me was that we're guys who don't do strong emotion very well, very much. Very well is a judgment, very much is the quantitative version. And in some ways, as I look around the world of men, and I see a lot of that same kind of thing, and people come into my office, and some people say, oh, the man I love, he doesn't do that emotion thing, and then men come in, and they're like, I don't really do that emotion thing. And I'm just like, okay, without getting into a big, like, gender essentialism thing, because people of all kinds have issues with emotions, I could take that one issue and I could say, oh, that's part of male oppression. I look around our culture and I see a lot of that mirrored, and I see it mirrored back to me. You know, I go to watch nearly anything, but to pick an example at random, one could say Iron Man. And I find archetypes of myself, right? I particularly like the Hulk as an archetype of maleness in this culture. Nerdy scientist, quite cute, good hair, kind of dorky, socially awkward, can't deal with his anger. Hooks up with a woman who he needs to kind of both get him to feel things, and then she uses him to make him angry sometimes because they need the Hulk around. And he's afraid of himself. And he ends up running away from engagement in both love and life because he's afraid that he'll get angry. And there's this amazing little exchange. Yeah, it's amazing. For Marvel, it's amazing. But there's a beautiful exchange where maybe it's Iron Man or one of the others, maybe it's Captain America, says to Banner, the Hulk guy, they've been talking earlier in the movie about how do you control it? And this is a great sort of male conversation. How do you control your anger? And the assumption in the movie is like you do things to control it, you know? You try not to get angry. That's male oppression lesson number one. And then later in the movie, as they approach the final climactic battle, and Banner knows he's going to turn into the, going to let himself turn into the Hulk again to save the day, and it's going to hurt. It always hurts, right? You can tell. He turns back to whichever one he was talking about. Does somebody know? Who was that? Which one? Marvel experts? Never mind. It was one of the others.
I think it was the Avengers movie.
It was in the Avengers movie, yeah. Yeah. And so it was one of the other Avengers. And he says, you want to know the secret, as he's heading into battle, which is the male moment to give a secret. I'm angry all the time. Right? And it flips the whole teaching on its head. It's not like I'm trying to not feel. It's that I'm always angry. And what I do is I'm repressing it until I can't. Mm-hmm. The conversation on male oppression doesn't get very far in this culture. It's a kind of small sub-conversation. It hasn't taken off in the progressive world in the same way that, like, you know, anti-racism or anti-sexism or you know, anti-homophobia has really kind of gotten its legs in a good way, partly because men are in power. And it's hard for someone in power, someone in privilege, like myself, to say, you know, hey, I'm oppressed. Which is why this essay, I think, hit such a nerve, is that this guy was saying, hey, I feel oppressed, but he named the wrong cause of his oppression and then stated it in a way that had no introspection to it, didn't look at himself or his own actions. But karmically speaking, and karma is both about the conditions that are at play in the system that give rise to my experience in the present, and it's the actions that I take in the present that give rise to both my experience in the immediate and far future and contribute to the next moment's conditions and onward. So I'm both part of the system and, in a certain way, a witness to it. And that paradox is at the heart of this whole thing, right? That I can both observe it and I'm in it. Part of what that means from an oppression perspective is that everyone is oppressed in a certain way because there's aspects that are systemic in the conditions that we've inherited that are painful. And we say that they're oppression rather than just like my feelings are hurt, when we can see that they are a certain degree of systemic and vast. So, you know, when my sweetheart says, you know, I don't like that you did that just there, and I say, oh, you just hurt my feelings, or whatever, some example where I could say my feelings got hurt, it would be wrong for me to say, like, oh, you're oppressing me right now. But when I feel in myself that thing that I inherited from my dad and his dad, if I want to say that there's a line of men, and we could even say, like, from all of our parents teaching us to be men in a certain way, I can say, oh, that's so much bigger than me, and it's impersonal. That's the thing that makes it oppression and not just, like, somebody hurt you individually. It's so much bigger than me, and it makes me part of a class of people. When I notice that, part of what I know about it is that karmic forces, which is one way we could call that, it's like it's a deep condition that goes way back, and you know, and I'm like, oh, you know, look at Thor. I'm going to use Marvel examples. You know, like an ancient Norse guy, right? In the Marvel world, they're not gods. They're just aliens, but they have these sort of things. They showed up in Norway at a certain point, and people were like, whoa, gods. Thor is clearly, you know, subject to male oppression in his way, right? He's learned things about machismo, etc. He's really out of whack when he can't use his hammer anymore. Sorry, dude. And we can see a certain flavor of that, like I'm just like I'm thinking about Vikings, and I'm thinking about the whole spread of an ideology of male means strong, means violent, means et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of this is a way of saying that what I think we are asked to do, compelled to do, if we take our practice of inner cultivation seriously, is that when we find in ourselves both the response to and the maintenance of these ancient karmic patterns that we call oppressions, we must do what we can to uproot them. And it's a mistake to turn outward in a certain way for those of us in power. And this is particular to men in power. And now I just want to say, like, this is very complicated as I'm sort of sorting it out in my mind, and you can probably tell. I'm like, oh, this has so many threads to it. Because, of course, you know, for those systemically disempowered in this culture, this is a whole different conversation around the positionality or the placement of one who is so constantly oppressed by systemic conditions that in a certain sense, there's not even enough safety to turn inward in some cases. And I talked some months ago about a spectrum that I call privileged trauma. Essentially, the conditions that came to us from the past are either conducive to ease or conducive to pain and dis-ease. Conditions from the past that are conducive to ease we call privilege. And conditions from the past that are conducive, that lead to more pain, are called trauma. And in a sense, then, privilege isn't something to get rid of, nor trauma in a certain way, as much as both are things to overcome through practice. And we want to give the traumatized more privileges. That's the leveling or uplifting part of our practice. We do this because we recognize how harmful systemic oppression is. If I can feel how deep male oppression is in myself, how deep must it be for someone in whom that pain is not buttressed by all the other privileges of power, but is deepened by added layers of disempowerment. So for those in power, and this is partly a sermon, a scolding for them, for us, if you consider yourself part of that group, and you may or may not. This is an urge to recognize that the very thing that might arise in us that's defensive, that is sometimes called like white fragility, to jump to race as a metaphor. We could call this male fragility. The defensiveness itself arises as a result of the oppressive patterns we've inherited, right? If I'm unable to be vulnerable and present and active, I'm responding to those conditions in a certain way. So, if my practice is, if the conditions that I'm in as I practice are such that I can do the work of looking at the threads that, like the threads of force that come through me and come out as my own actions, I absolutely will want to be free of the suffering that's visiting me, and I will absolutely not want to pass on that same suffering or the echo of that suffering to others. I hope that what this leads to, the response to this person's essay and reflecting on it in this way, and I hope that what it leads to is a continuation of a movement that I do see happening in our culture right now, where those in privilege or positions of power in some tiny subcultures that I happen to be a part of, and respect, or others that I respect, that those in privilege or power actually begin to have the tools to do this work more and more, and the spaces that allow them to do it. And it is totally happening. There are, the Good Men Project is an attempt to do this for men. There's lots of stuff out there that is that attempt, in different ways, right? And there's unlearning white racism, et cetera, et cetera. There's all these things that are now happening, particularly around here. So this is partly a hope that we do those, and a hope that our practice itself learns how to never think that our own inner process is separate from the system that we are embedded in. We always see the weave between, or the relationship between my experience and others' experience, my actions and others' experience. So, may the demons of intolerance be destroyed. Thanks so much. Felt a little rambly. I knew I wanted to talk about it, and I didn't actually know how to. So thank you for that. I'm going to write about it soon and maybe organize myself a little more clearly. Let's take a moment to just rest. Thanks for your kindness and your listening, and a particular and different thanks to those who identify as men and those who identify as women or other than men in the room. It's a different talk depending on who you are. So thanks for your patience as I try to put words to something here with you. And I'd love to hear from any of you your thoughts and feelings and just your wisdom around oppression or around this particularly. Please.
Do you think it's possible to help raise an oppressed class without, as a member of the privileged class, voluntarily giving up some of your power? Like the scarcity thing we were talking about, like, do you think there is only a certain amount to go around that some of us have to give over some to others, or is it possible to help lift everyone to the same level without coming down?
So it depends what we mean by giving up. If we're literal about what power means, you know, if there's only 100 Senate seats and we want 51 of them to be occupied by women, less men need to get elected. Like, maybe there's some literal giving up, right? If there's only 60 minutes of time in a meeting, and the same two guys always take up all the time, they need to give up some of that time to hear the voices of other people. You know. And of course that's an ironic thing to say, having just, you know, talked for 45 minutes to you all. And every time, in a certain way, as I teach in the yoga world, I'm almost always in rooms that are 90% women. And I teach primarily history and philosophy. And I don't know of a single woman teaching in the yoga world in the Bay Area who emphasizes history and philosophy. Lots of women doing amazing and complex and subtle physical practice. Very few focusing solely on meditation or inquiry or history or philosophy. So the old division, women do body and men do mind, is right here, you know. And so when I teach these teacher training groups, you know, I'll often say, like, hey, if you like this thing, you know, like the history of philosophy thing, like, please dig in and come and let's do it, let's read, let's, you know, let me give you as much as I can to support you in doing this, and please do this, and, like, let's see if we can shift that, you know. And so, yeah, I think that it's not that there's a scarcity in a certain way. Like, there's no scarcity of, like, the possibility of respect, for instance. But material liberation is a material task, and there is limited materials. So in a certain way, we're talking about the bare bones of economic reality and things like that. You know. So in that sense, yes, for sure. Yeah.
Sorry for coming in late, by the way. I got myself locked out by accident.
No worries.
It's interesting. I was at a retreat this past weekend on the theme of disentangling patriarchy.
Nice.
And it was beautiful, and it was people of all genders. And I had this kind of interesting and frustrating reflection that in that space, we had maybe 30 or 40 people, very diverse in terms of gender identity and sexual orientation. And it was really interesting because I came in so excited to just like get into it and like share pain and share experiences as a woman, and then realizing that I was a straight cis woman in a room full of actually almost half people who I identified as genderqueer or trans,
yep.
that I actually needed to make space for those voices within even yep. what I was feeling was a safe space for me to kind of finally get to like take a load off. And it was
yes.
just kind of frustrating how small a slice of pie it felt like there was
mm-hmm.
for us to share space and for
mm-hmm.
our voices to really be heard on this topic
yeah.
in front of men
yeah.
or like male-bodied people.
Yep.
And it was really interesting. It was a really difficult internal dynamic of coming like ready to unload all this stuff and then actually having to hold a lot of it in to leave space for
mm-hmm.
other voices. And I just, I don't know, I just wanted to share that. It was a realization that oftentimes I think through these oppressive systems, that oppression then also carries down into the oppressed
sure.
arenas. And
sure.
There just needs to be so much more space. It's something that I realized, and I felt so
yeah.
grateful for the men who showed up to listen.
Yeah.
And that felt like a really amazing way for people with privilege to give. And so, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I appreciate you bringing this as a topic into.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm glad you got to go to that. And I recognize that particular ache in those spaces. It's one of the reasons why, and the reactionary right wing also doesn't understand this. It's why separation spaces are appropriate. You know, why it would be appropriate for, you know, a bunch of, you know, cisgendered women or cisgendered straight white women, or whatever small enough category of folks who are privileged to gather themselves to do some of that unloading. Because in a certain way, there's so much uplift that needs to happen that in a certain way, you know, even the parts of ourselves that are variable have to be modulated in a certain way. You know, so like, you know, when I'm in a mixed race gathering, I might want to speak about my experience of being mixed race. But the fact that I'm, you know, a cisgendered, straight passing, highly educated, white passing man in this culture means that even the aspect of my experience that has an oppression to it is going to take up space from someone whose experience is more consuming, even though we can't assess that. And I can't even claim that,
mm-hmm.
right? So then there's this beautiful kind of sensitivity, I think, that we develop, where it's almost like, how much do I have to give? And can I do that? Can I actually like make space for others this much? And when I need to be... when I need to move my own process along, what is the right container for it,
mm-hmm.
right? And there would have been folks in that room who are oppressed in such a particular way that even that space wouldn't have been safe enough for them to enter into.
Yeah.
And that's a different experience than yours,
yeah.
where you it was safe enough for you, but it wasn't spacious enough because you wanted to give time to others. And so... you know, there's a beautiful aspect of the mindfulness teachings. This is in the original text on mindfulness in the early Buddhist scriptures, where you are enjoined to be aware of your own body, mindful of the body, of yourself, mindful of the body of another, and mindful of both. And that instruction, yourself, another, and both, threads through the whole text. So you're to be mindful of your own breath, and mindful of another's breath, and mindful of both. Mindful of your mind states, mindful of another's mind states, and mindful of both. And that's, I think, one of the earliest places we can go to if we want to talk about what contemplative practice, contemplative inquiry as a relational field is. And it demands this incredible kind of subtlety and generosity of spirit. You know, how much space can we make for others? Yeah. Yeah, thanks for bringing it. Feelings. Yeah.
Sean, I really appreciate how you said, this is what I wish he had said, or something like that.
Mm.
And you took it from the angle of what might be going on inside of him. This is how I heard it, and sort of an empathy. What was he feeling that was causing this to happen? And then what could we do with that?
Yeah.
And I really, really appreciated that. I mean, that I feel can be applied in so many different ways.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, I don't want to join the chorus of folks saying in a very simple way that he's just a shithead. And other things. But really to say, and again, this is a practice that I think this discipline commits us to if we take it on, is to always, no matter what's happening, say, what's the suffering here? Right? Anytime. Right, that whole thing about karma means anytime unskillful or harmful action is being done, somebody is suffering. The doer is suffering. Right? There's a teaching that says that at a certain point of liberation, it's impossible to break the precepts. You just can't do it. And it's because your vision for knowing the results of your actions is so clarified that you simply can't give rise to the motivation to cause harm. And that's because your inner liberation is that strong. And so until that point, we could say, and who knows what levels of liberation means for us now. We'll talk about that someday. It's clear to me that if someone is doing something that causes harm, and my sense is that his post certainly caused insult, if not was a representation of a deep societal harm happening right now, that somebody's suffering in order to have to express that in that way.
Yeah.
In order that was his last straw. I'm like, really? And in a certain way, I could take it in other directions. I could say, oh, we as the yoga community didn't serve this guy at all. Like we did, we, if there's a we, did nothing to help him find a different way of being in the world. And that's a failure. That we could call that a communal failure. And then I would want to rewind that a little bit, and I could say, you know, maybe it's the men in the yoga community, we would say, failed him in a certain way. Anything else? Other thoughts? Yeah.
Sean, could you talk a little, a few weeks ago you talked about equipoise.
Yeah.
And can you talk a little bit about, like, witnessing, holding this, and also right action, and how, I mean, you said just a minute ago, having the awareness of the other person, having the awareness of yourself, and having the awareness of the space between this, because this is an obvious correlation to all of us and the government, and how to respond, how to hold it, how to be
dharmic. Yeah, no, for sure. It's about our time to stop, and so I can't say much, but no worries, I asked. Equanimity is a pattern in myself, not a guideline for how I act. In other words, equanimity is about how I experience, how I process pain and pleasure. And it's about processing pain and pleasure that I receive in a more balanced way, in a way that's balanced in my heart. Wise action, I would say the connection between equanimity and wise action is that if I can find some degree of equanimity, non-reactivity to pleasure and pain, I can make my choices for how to act consciously rather than unconsciously. Mm-hmm. Right? I have choice rather than reactive habit. Right? And that's what I want. Right? And once I have choice, then I get to use whatever guidelines feel most wholesome to me to find my actions. And if I want to use the Buddhist guidelines, I start with the precepts. You know. And that's a relief because, you know, how many times am I moving through the world, I get a little impulse, and then I get that little hint of like, oh, does that break a precept? And that's all I want. Is what I want is my commitment to an ethical framework to just ring a little bell in me whenever my impulse is to do something that hits that boundary. And I don't know what that's going to be, right? I'm cruising through the grocery store, and I have an impulse, flirt with that person. And it may or may not be appropriate, right? Depending on the fine grain of my relational structure at the moment. Mm-hmm. But what I want, because the impulse to flirt is a very powerful impulse, mm-hmm. I want my precepts to be really awake because I don't trust impulse. Mm. Right? This is a place I go against the vast current of the New Age. We'll talk about it some other time. Don't trust your impulses. Right? Your impulses are primal and they're based in desire and self-protection. They're beautiful and animalistic and gorgeous, and until we have some momentum in ethical containment, they're a bit like my toddler who wants everything. So we'll pause there. Thank you for your presence. I'm happy to hear more from anyone about this kind of topic, especially those for whom it's a sensitive topic. Feel free to write me or chat me up sometime. Our gathering is entirely based on the gift economy of your generosity. Thank you for your donations. They go in the little basket. And I will see you again next week. Take good care.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much.